The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Victor Wooten. An original member of jazz fusion supergroup Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, bass guitarist Victor Wooten is a five-time Grammy winner and has been called the Michael Jordan of the bass. A producer, songwriter, and solo touring artist, he is the only person to thrice be voted Bassist of the Year in Bass Player Magazine's Reader's Poll and was named one of the top 10 bassists of all time by Rolling Stone. He's also the author of the novel, The Music Lesson, A Spiritual Search for Growth Through Music. Victor is here tonight with The Spirit of Music, The Lesson Continues, called a, quote, sparkling manifesto and a heartfelt and wildly imaginative foray into the power of music. It tells the story of three strangers mystically summoned to Nashville, Tennessee, to save the sound of live instrumentation and song for the whole world. Tonight, Victor will be in conversation with Wesley Stace, an honored guest on our stage several times in his own right. As a novelist, he is the author of four books, and under the stage name John Wesley Harden, he has recorded nearly two dozen folk rock albums. He is also the creator and curator of the popular stage and radio show Cabinet of Wonders. Victor, Wes, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
All right.
Thank you very much. Hello, Victor. Good evening to you.
Nashville. Wesley, good evening to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. We're so happy that you could join us, as are all the participants here tonight. We're excited to talk to you and have you tell us about your book. But can I first go back a little bit?
Yes.
And not that I'm obsessed with what we call things, but you have written one book before this one, as mentioned. Tell us about that book and let's lead into this book and describe, you know, whether they are novels or not novels.
Absolutely. I don't really know what they are. You know, I'm a musician, Wesley. I play bass guitar. I make music with four strings. I just decided to pick up a pen and tell a whimsical story for the first book, The Music Lesson. Mm-hmm. And this book was called The Music Lesson, A Spiritual Search for Growth Through Music. And the way that book came about, Wesley, is I started, I guess, in the early 90s, and then eventually in the 2000s, where I started teaching. So with the rise of the popularity of Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, people started recognizing me as a bassist. And I wound up in Bass Player magazine a lot. I found out right away that if you're in that magazine enough, people think you must be able to play. So I started being asked to teach. I had never taught anything. But in figuring out how to teach, I realized that I wanted to go in a different direction than the mainstream. Where most people were teaching notes, I decided to teach everything but the notes. Or even when I dealt with the notes, I wanted to do it in a different way. Not that people weren't teaching good things. They were teaching great things, but I felt that there were enough people teaching that. So I was looking at things like tone, rhythm, articulation, phrasing, dynamics, space, when not to play a note, how to play space. I found out that most people taught space as if you weren't playing. And I say, no, if I write music and I don't want sound to come out, I write something that says play this, where you play space. So I realized I wanted to help people learn to play the space, to tune in, not tune out when they're not playing. So I started teaching. And in the year 2000, I started running my own music camps, and I was always combining nature and, you know, nature instruction and nature teachers, because when you see someone that's really good at something, you call them a natural. That person's a natural. But I couldn't find any nature in the music lessons that I had, you know, been seeing. We were actually told to lock ourselves in a room and practice. And I thought, I didn't learn to talk by locking myself in a room. You know, I got out of the room and participated in life so that I had something to say, and then talking was easy. So, you know, I understood the normal way of teaching music, but it wasn't going to be my way because I didn't learn that way, being the youngest of five brothers. So as I started teaching, and I'm trying to cut this story short, Wesley, as I started teaching, people started asking me.
There's no need to cut it short.
That's right. He just told us we got 4 hours tonight, right? Is that what? Just kidding. Okay. So as I started teaching the way I was taught, Wesley, I'm the youngest of five brothers. And Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, as he mentioned, my brother is known as Future Man. One of my brothers, Future Man, he's the drummer. And he thinks differently. All my brothers think differently. And so I learned music in a different way than the norm. So I was teaching the way I learned, and people were saying you should write a book. And I felt everyone was asking for a music instruction book, a how-to, a Wooten method per se, which is exactly what I didn't want. I like pointing people in directions, but I don't want to tell you how to play. It's your story, you tell it. So I stayed away from writing a book until it dawned on me that I could write a story. And I had gotten in a friend's car who had a book by Richard Bach called Illusions.
Aha.
And yeah.
That's one of my, that's something I have written down here.
One of my all-time favorites.
Very interesting.
I even tipped my hat early on in the music lesson. I tipped my hat to Richard Bach and a couple other authors that inspired me. But in seeing my friend's book in his car when he picked me up from the airport, it hit me that, you know, in my mind, I didn't say anything out loud, but in my mind, I said, you know, I read this book when I was about 14 or 15. I bet I could write this book now. And a light bulb went off. That's the way to write the book people have been asking for. Not an instruction book, not a how-to. Don't write a book you'll have to defend. I wrote a story and called it a parable, or called it fiction. And that's what came out as the music lesson. And basically I patterned that book after the lessons I had been teaching, where each chapter, and instead of calling them chapters, I called them measures. I kept it music. Yeah, that's right. What I know. I don't know writing, I know music. So I called each chapter a measure. And then I wrote each measure about an element of music. So there's a chapter, there's a measure on tone. There's one on rhythm, one on technique, one on articulation, tone, phrasing. But I did it in the way that our parents made us do it. Meaning my parents, especially my mom, would always tell us boys, she would ask us, what does the world need with just another good musician? She would say, what the world needs are good people. So all of our lessons had to make us better as people, not just musicians. And even to take it further, it had to make everyone we came in contact better. So I wrote the book with that mindset, that music is just a representation and a way of expressing life. And so the book is a spiritual search for growth through music, the music lesson. And so I wrote that book, but still had more to say. So I wrote a second one.
And so there are obviously memoirish elements to all of them, to both books. There are fictional elements to all of them. There are what I would call loosely allegorical elements to all of them. There's yes. Wizard of Ozzy elements to this one, I think. it's funny yeah. because I was trying to think of what book I had read like The Spirit of Music and what books might have inspired you. And I did think of, you know, Jonathan Livingston Seagull was what I wrote down. I haven't read Illusions, but that's what I wrote down. And then I also thought of, you know, because please don't be in any way think I'm saying anything remotely critical, but it seemed to me to be having a space between one of those books that's a little Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Gibran, the Prophet, Castaneda, that kind of world, and also like Bill and Ted, kind of going, what the world needs now is real music played live, and that's how we're going to save the universe. And yes. It seems to me that your book is opera and Wizard of Oz, I'd put there. And it seems to me that this one, so anyway, so let's move forward to the spirit of music. You felt, because the first one was well received and you were happy with it, you felt that there was more to say about it. What was your kind of leaping off point for going, let's have another look at this and let's think about it again?
Sure. Well, it had a whole lot to do with, in the first book, there's a chapter called The Dream with a question mark, where my character, the narrator, has a conversation with music. And in the audiobook version of the first book, my mom read the role of music, so I get to hear her voice. She's long passed on now, but she was alive and read the part of music. And so I'm happy. This, in the new book, a great vocalist, one of my favorites, India Ari. Once the audio book comes out, you'll hear her voice as the voice of music. But to answer you, Wesley, during the latter part of the music lesson, you find out that music is saying that she is sick.
Yeah.
And that I'm dying, that I have more of an intimate relationship with computers than I do with humans nowadays. And she's saying, I need to be felt. People don't feel me the way they used to. I wanted to not really answer that question, but raise more questions about that. I didn't want to leave that there. That was one of the things I wanted to continue with this next book, which is basically the premise of it, is that music is dying around the world, and a few of us are coming together to do our best to save her. And so in the first book, The Music Lesson, where I wanted to make music feel easy, whether you play an instrument or not, I want you to recognize that you have a relationship with music. It doesn't mean you got to lock yourself in a room and learn all these rules before you can play. Everyone has it, a child, an old person, in between. We all have a connection with music. And I wanted everyone to feel that in an easy, happy, simple way. Now that I hopefully pulled you into our musical world, I wanted to show you the responsibility that we have to be in this world. And I wanted to poke at people a little bit and make you a little bit uncomfortable. Because to me, that's when we learn the most about ourselves, when we dare to reach the edge of our comfort zone. And that's what this book is geared to do. And, you know, by raising different ideas and things, not only about music, but about how music pertains to all of our lives. And what will we lose if music disappears?
I'm very interested to hear you talk about your mother, because something that struck me very forcibly during the book, and so it doesn't surprise me at all to hear you say that about the earlier audiobook, is your relationship to great forces and maternity. You're very strong on Mother Nature early on, and you're very, that therefore becomes continuous with mother music, as it were, to you.
Correct.
So,
correct.
So just tell us about your mother for a bit, and her, and of course, a very important chapter. Well, the first chapter of the book really is you going to your parents, and saying, what should I do now? So obviously, I did think this is somebody whose, my mother died on May the 1st last year, and she was a singing teacher herself and a chairman of a music festival in England. And I very much also associate motherhood, mothers and music. So tell me about your mother and that chapter about her, that in the teaching chapter, and tell us about that.
Sure. Well, you know, you have to think about what it must have been like for people of color born in the 30s and what they were going through to survive. You had to be much better than normal. There was no way to live a normal life and survive. What we call a pandemic was life for them. So my parents were smart. They were spiritual. They were religious. They had clairvoyance, my parents. The five of us boys grew up really, really good. You know, of course, when I was five was when we started doing around 5 years old is when we started doing lots of shows. I was touring with my brothers. We were the opening band for Curtis Mayfield's Superfly tour when we were living on the West Coast. Played a lot of nightclubs, and being young in that atmosphere, we saw a lot of things that grown-ups do. What grown-ups do in nightclubs that, you know, after midnight. We saw all this stuff. But at the same time, none of my brothers have ever drank any alcohol. None of them ever smoke. You can't even get a curse word out of them. So that's how I grew up. But a big part of it was, is if we did anything wrong, it didn't matter where our mom was on the planet, she would know about it. So for me personally, I grew up thinking that was normal. And I was probably in high school before I realized it wasn't normal. I mean, everybody's parents wasn't like that. And it was the time where my brother and I, Joseph, who's next to the youngest, we actually went to high school at the same time. When I was in the ninth grade, he was a senior. So when I was in the ninth grade, he was a senior, we went to some kind of high school dance. I don't remember what it was, the homecoming or something. He was driving, we had dates. We're all dressed up, four of us in the car, and we get pulled over by the police. And the police were very kind. They looked at us, saw that we were dressed nicely, and they told us someone with the description of your car robbed a 7-Eleven or something like that. We know it wasn't you. Have a merry night. Have a good night. They let us go. But my mom, who was 3 hours away, we were living in Virginia at the time, but she was in North Carolina at her mom's house. She calls home. I can't remember if it was the next night or later that night. It had to be the next night. But she called home asking what happened. And I was like, what are you talking about? She says, I saw the lights. You know what I'm talking about. Tell me what happened. She says, I wasn't worried, but I know I saw the lights. So tell me what happened. And so now, maybe I'm ninth grade, so I'm a little bit older. And I know what she's talking about, but now I'm realizing, you know, this is not normal. So I say, well, what time was it, Mom? So she tells me the exact time. You know, I'm questioning her instead of just, you know, accepting it. I'm like, okay, this isn't normal. Tell me more, Mom. And she's like, boy, you know what I'm talking about, you know. So she tells me, you know, what time it was and everything. So I tell her what happened. And that really clicked in my mind, like, okay, this is not normal for everybody. What is going on here? And I really started paying attention to her. My dad had the same type of thing, except he was usually quiet about it. And then I realized my aunts and uncles had the same thing. So that has governed my life and my brother's lives. And so music is attached to that. My parents didn't play music, but they were very musical. And so that being a big foundation of how I've lived my life and what I've had to live with my whole life, it finds its way into everything I say, do, or write about.
So tell us quickly, because we want to know, what did your parents do, and what music were they listening to that was so must have been so influential upon you?
Exactly. So my mom every Sunday would put on some Mahalia Jackson or some, you know, usually a female gospel singer on vinyl, of course. My dad, when he was young, before I was born, living in North Carolina, on the weekends, they could get AM radio and they could hear the Grand Ole Opry. So other than that gospel and the soul music of that time, he loved listening to Burl Ives and all these great country singers. So he used to love to sing that kind of stuff. You know, so when we were young, Wesley, pop music was not a style of music. Pop music just was short for popular. So yes, we had classical radio stations. We had jazz radio stations, rock and funk. The pop stations played it all, as long as it was popular. So as kids, we were influenced by all of it, even though as a kid as kids, the five of us were being hired to play R&B dances. We were playing for mostly black audiences, black dances at the military bases. My dad was military, fought in the Korean War.
Right, right.
So we played in a lot of the black dances, black clubs, and you know, black concerts. So I did that from about five, starting around 5 years old. So that was my main influence, but I was still aware of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and you know, and a lot of the rock bands and classical bands. I was aware of all of it, except that I was playing mostly, you know, Motown, Stevie Wonder, James Brown, and stuff like that. And our parents would take us to those concerts. So, yeah.
Oh, they would, huh?
Oh, yeah. I got to see James Brown when I was in kindergarten and the first grade live. And I'll never forget those concerts, the best concerts I've ever been to date.
I can see why, therefore, you, to me, it's very clear, as it is to you, why you associate concepts of mother music and mother nature, which are omnipotent things, with your mother, who seems to have had that kind of omnipotent, clairvoyant knowledge of whatever you were up to, where you were up to. Now, just tell us, what do you remember? I mean, just, I ask as a fan, and because it's fun to know, tell us about Curtis Mayfield. What are your memories of him when you were so young? And he was that was him in his glory days. And I watched that movie within a month. So I was listening just the music when the credits start in that movie and the song starts up. It's so fantastic. What was he like?
Yeah, super fly. Well, I'm always going to be strictly honest. I was so young. I think Reggie told me that I turned 6 during that tour. Reggie's my oldest brother. So I don't remember him much at all. What I do remember is what my brothers have continued to talk about since those days was Curtis's music. And one of the things that we learned very early about Curtis Mayfield, what he taught us about music just by listening to him, was how to be intense at a soft volume. He always sang in a high falsetto, and he never got above a little bit loud. You know, like super fly. Doom, doom, doom. It was just like boiling water, just bubbling a little bit.
That's right. That's
never great. Was splat. Yeah. Never splattering, just right there, really cool. And that little soft falsetto. And his musicians were great. So I remember more about his music. The one thing that I usually don't even share, the one thing I kind of remember that happened one time is we played at a big Coliseum in Sacramento. And this was not a good situation. And I don't like to paint this kind of picture of Curtis Mayfield. But one of the things that I remember strongly is laying in my mom's lap backstage. And I could feel the tenseness, the thickness of the air. And I found out later that what had happened was there was supposed to be 2 shows that night. And there was a sold out audience waiting to get in for the second show. But Curtis and his people had gotten paid for both shows and split.
Oh.
So everybody there knew, at least backstage, we knew there was not going to be a second show. And the promoters and all this stuff are walking around trying to figure out what to do because people are ready to come in. And I don't remember this. I just remember hearing about it from that night on. Apparently someone walked over to us 5 young boys. So you got to think about it. If I'm six, my oldest brother's only 14. So we got 5 boys between 6 and 14 with our parents there. And some gentleman walks over to us and says, "Hey, boys, you should get out of show business while you're young." And I'll never forget that. And fortunately, we listened but didn't obey, and we kept doing it. But that's some of the memories that I have. And because of that, I've really studied Curtis Mayfield's music since then.
We shouldn't talk about it now, but I mean, I'm a very big fan of all those records, Sweet Exorcist, and there's such great records. And you're right, it's that feeling of the bubbling of rock music beneath that soft singing. It's so beautiful. Yes. He's like the Nick Drake of soul. It's so fantastic. Okay, back to more important matters, although it's lovely to talk about that. So onto this one, you know, we're gonna deal with that one a little bit more in depth. Would it be fair to say that an argument you are making in the book, and we're both musicians, you know, and mm-hmm. I know about recording trickery, I know about auto-tune, I know about quantizing, I know when my voice has been, I mean, I don't want any auto-tuning on my voice, but sometimes someone has a go at it and you can hear how it's smoothed it out and made, but there are other people who take auto-tune to the nth level and make it kind of an art form of its own, which has become a dominant vocal characteristic these days, as we all know.
Yes.
Are you basically saying in the book that those kind of recording techniques are, you know, in a sense, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but dehumanizing music in a basically negative way? Or, so deal with that. Or are you kind of saying those are great things when used well, which I read clearly in the book, but that there's something that only really the live approach to it can do?
Well, I think that people will think I'm saying the first thing you said, that they're bad.
Yes.
And if you read closely, I never say that. I raise the question, are we losing something? Is it possible that we, you know, is it possible that the glass can be becoming half empty rather than half full? You know, I'm raising the questions and I want the reader to think about it. We don't have to come up with answers, but I want it to think about it, because I play an electric bass and I tune it before I play it. You know, if I could auto-tune it, I might do that too. But so I'm not against the auto tuning or anything. The same way I talk about GMOs in there and the modification of foods done right, it can be beneficial. I also say I believe Mother Nature got it right the first time, and I do believe that. But we have doctors, we have people who can modify things in a way that is better. But we need to be careful with any modification upon Mother Nature's recipe. And in music, and I think it kind of, I start with the analogy when I talk about listening to live music being a foot, listening to vinyl being 8 inches, listening to a CD being 6 inches, listening to an MP3 is only a tenth the size of a CD. So now we're at a half an inch. Put that half an inch through headphones or stereo or computer speakers, now we may be at a quarter of an inch. And so, and that this quarter of an inch is what our kids are growing up as normal. And then the music that our kids grow up to, everything is auto-tuned, all of it. All of it is compressed, meaning all the, you don't hear anything soft on the radio. It's all compressed so that it's loud, like TV commercials. Everything is quantized, meaning all the rhythms are digitally corrected, quantized. So we're not getting all the pitches. Our kids are not getting all the pitches. They're not getting all the rhythms. They're not definitely not getting all the frequencies. And this has happened so quickly. Should we be alarmed? Should we be aware? The fact that you and I grew up listening to records with a group of people. It was an event when someone bought a new record. Now people don't listen to records anymore. Not the whole thing. Our kids download the songs they want, listen to them out of order, but claim they've heard the whole record, right? So what I'm asking, is it possible that we are missing something? Is it possible that we are losing? If we've gone from a foot to a quarter of an inch in a life, in one generation, is it possible? And so I try to do my best. I mean, you can tell through the book what I think, but I'm trying my best to not tell people what to think, and more so raise questions. As you see in the book, you know, questions to me is what's more important than answers.
Yeah, and I think also that, you know, we all realize that those technological advances can be used in incredibly creative ways, which does further the way things are done, but also, so that's good, and also there's a kind of Luddism possibility where you can be going, nah, I think I'm only going to make my records now on, you know, wire cylinders and out in nature with the use of no, you know, that it's also kind of a bit ridiculous, except it's retro and appealing. Sorry, I had something right here. Okay, now there are also, oh, and by the way, I want to say that we're going to, Victor and I are going to stop chatting in about 10 minutes, and then we're going to have a full 20 minutes of questions and chat. So if you want to answer questions and put them along the side here, I can see them and I will be asking them to Victor in a few minutes. So just bear that in mind. Are you into, or have you ever been into, I'm just interested to know, having just read the book, science fiction, because there seems to be a kind of dystopian, you know, edge to the book where you are, okay, so you're not saying all technology is bad, but you are certainly positing the phasers. So tell everybody who might not have read the book about them and, sure. And also how that kind of, you know, I don't know, Clockwork Orangey or RoboCop-like thing. Where, tell us where that comes from, kind of in your life.
Yeah, well, I think any musician who's played for any length of time has run into the topic or phrase of something being, a signal being out of phase, in phase or out of phase. Sometimes you plug in your guitar or whatever and it just doesn't sound right. And you find out that it's out of phase, they flip a switch, it reverses one of the signals and boom, the sound is back. So when something's out of phase, a sound is drastically reduced. And so in this book, it is a I don't know if to call them people or whatever, but represented by the name the Phasers, is these entities, these group of people or whatever, that are putting music out of phase with their phase canceling headphones that they're always wearing. But music is disappearing around the world, and in most cases the phasers are present when it's happening. And yeah, I've always, of course, been into science fiction. You know, I grew up, you know, when Star Wars was happening. For me, like, my one of my favorite movies was The Wizard of Oz, and that was, to me, kind of one of the first science fiction type movies, you know, because it was I don't know if we classified as that, but that's how I see it.
Yeah.
But the idea of the phasers is looking at real life, okay, which is really what the book is looking at through a fictional tale or a fable. But if you think about this, there have been tons of studies, a lot of studies on the benefits of music in life. They've shown, someone actually just about 3 days ago sent me another study showing that, and this study was done by MIT, right? They're saying if you want kids to do well in school, teach them music, not coding. Right? And this is MIT, the biggest coding place in the world. They're saying teach these kids music because it's been shown over and over again through study, now by MIT, that if kids learn music at an early age, they're going to do better in all the other subjects. They learn when to talk, when to listen. They understand that a band's better when all the instruments are different. So they understand and accept differences in life, right? They don't try to make a bass into a flute. They let you be who you are. So kids are learning these principles of life through music at an early age. Now that we know that, why is it hard to get our kids into music? Why is it taken out of schools? Why is the importance of music been like kind of like demoralized and desensitized? And you know, now we just want it for free. We, you know, so is that done on purpose? A better analogy is like Coca-Cola. Nothing against Coca-Cola, except that I can buy a liter of it cheaper than I can buy an 8-ounce bottle of water. Now, as silly as that is, that has to be done on purpose. So instead of saying who's doing it or trying to figure it out, in this book, I just say it's the phasers. Right. It's the phasers that's trying to get rid of music.
It is a kind of a tech, what do you call that? Like the, not the technophobes, but the opposite. It's the conquest of technology over kind of human emotion. Okay, sure. Now that reminded me of a couple of older white guys. Neil Young is, of course, very, very keen on, you know, that MP3s are ruining our lives because they're so compressed and they make us depressed. And what we need is the whole Sound of Music. And the world is kind of going, yes, but we don't really want to play anymore for the whole Sound of Music. But the moment that the bit in your book that I found interesting was, I don't know. So what I want to know is it true that you kind of woke up at some point? This is a longer question than it needs to be, but I have to start in this. Is it true that you kind of woke up and felt out of touch with your music practice and needed to get back together with it? Because when I was reading the Dylan book recently, not that recently, but what I remember about it is that's a whole chapter of Dylan's memoir. He was like, I just didn't want to, I didn't feel connected. And with him, I seem to remember it was because he started hanging out with the Grateful Dead and they were jamming and it made him enjoy it, and I can't quite remember. With me, I've been making albums for 30 years, but I'm a very lazy songwriter. I just do it when I feel like it.
And, same here.
And so I don't worry about it. So I want to know, is that thing you posit of the character in your book, which we take to be you to a certain extent, mm-hmm. Do you ever was there a particular thing that led you to be writing about that, a kind of a crisis of that kind? Or like me, is it more casual than that for you?
It is more casual. There's some of that that's very, very me, and some of it that's, I see it in so many other people that I wanted to portray that, right, and give people a way out. Now, right, I don't feel like I ever really lost connection to music. I've always played it. I was born into it. There are some days I don't feel like playing, but sure, my brothers have always been there for me, with me, and we've always played together. But I did find a time when I realized my connection with music could be deeper. And when I found out that there was a whole deeper part of music, a whole nother layer. And I'm sure it's like, you know, approaching music is like trying to count to infinity. You don't get any closer to the end, right? But you do get further from the beginning. And that's what was happening for me, is that I'm realizing, wait a minute, I can go deeper. And one of the things that led me to that is when I started realizing and then teaching music as a language. I realized that the same way we learn to speak, if we learn to speak music the same way, we'd be good really early on. And I figured that out because that's exactly how I learned. Wesley, when I was born, my brothers knew I was the bass player. So they just put a toy. When I could sit up by myself, a toy would be there. I'd pick up the toy, they'd be jamming. I'd jam along. That's exactly how we learn to talk. The pros are jamming, talking. We get the baby talk with them. Nobody corrected us. Nobody said, it's not a blankie. Go practice. Call it a blanket, you know? No one told us what words to learn first. I learned music that freely. And so I've always been free with it. I never had to feel like I worked hard, in the same sense that you didn't feel like you had to work hard to learn your first language.
Yeah.
Right. So, but when I started teaching it as a language, I started saying, well, I could say, hey, Wesley. And if Wesley's the only Wesley in the room, only Wesley's going to turn around and answer me and say, what? If music's really a language, can I do that with music? Can I call one person out of the crowd? You know, can I really speak with this? And I started exploring it, and I answered yes to all the questions and found out how to do it. And a whole new world of music opened up. And just like a good friend who knows you'll listen, they'll tell you secrets. It seemed like when music found out I was ready to listen on that level, more secrets started opening up. So then we started running a music camp called The Spirit of Music. We've been doing that for maybe 8 years or so. So the people who have been to my camp called The Spirit of Music, they're reading a different book when they read this.
Right. That's
they're going, oh, yes. When they hear about a giraffe, so there's one little place in the book that talks about a giraffe. It's light bulbs are going to go off in their heads, right? I've actually hidden song titles of my records throughout the book. Every chapter has at least two song titles. So there's little gems that, depending on where you are, will determine what these things mean in the book.
It's very interesting. Somebody else who runs a music camp is a fantastic guitar player called Jorma Kaukonen.
Jorma, yeah. Yeah.
Jorma, I was on tour with a lot. And it's just a story to illustrate what you were saying. And I said, because I'm a folkie mostly. And I said, and he said, oh, all you need to, he said, you know what the best folk guitar playing ever is? And I was like, oh, what's he going to say? You know, Gary Davis, what's it going to be? You know, and he said, it's Joan Baez's first three albums. Joan Baez, that's all you need to know about that folk guitar picking. And I told Joan Baez that at a later date when we were on the road or something. And she said, oh, do you know that? And this is why I mentioned this. She said, the interesting thing is that after having played the guitar like that for 20 years, I forgot everything and learned to play the guitar all over again from a teacher because I wanted to know how to do it properly. So that thing, you know, and she just wanted new chops and she went back to basics. Having had all her work already described to me, for one, by Jorma, one of the greats, as the best you could possibly do it. And to me, that's always such a heartening story about musicians. That's a real musician, isn't it? When you're ready to strip it away and start again.
Yeah. And the thing is that you really can't strip it away. That foundation that you've built upon is so solid. Yes. Right. And this is like eyesight. The further you go, the further you can see, you know, and there's no end to music. So, music is will take us as far as we want to go. And that's what I'm interested in. How far can we go?
Two questions from Glenn Bell. We're moving into the music questions, the questions from the people watching, which is a lot of people. His first question seems to me trivial, but you might be amused by it. Does Victor still drink pine top tea?
Yes, even though it's been a while since I've had it. There's a place in the book where I walk into my mom's house and she has literally a limb from a pine tree in a big pot. And this is something that they used to make when they were young, growing up poor on the farm. You can't afford to go to the doctor. So you know what all the plants do. And after I had moved to Nashville, Tennessee in 1989, I started studying nature with this man in New Jersey named Tom Brown Jr. And I paid about, $600 for my first class with Tom. We spent a week in the woods. And one of the things that I learned from him was that One of the things I learned from him was that pine needles have five times the amount of vitamin C as orange juice. And so coming from that class, for whatever reason, Tom Brown, my mom had read his books also, but Tom Brown let me videotape his classes. He never let anyone videotape his classes. And even the instructors that I'm still friends with, they still say, I don't know why he let you video. He doesn't let anyone video, but he let me video. My mom, knowing that I got the video, she said, when you leave that class, come straight to my house. So instead of going back to Nashville, I drove to Virginia because she wanted to use her words. She said, I want to look into his eyes. I want to see his eyes. She wanted to see my video and look into his eyes to see. I don't know what she wanted to see. But when I walked into her house with a little sniffle, because it was the first time I had ever slept in a tent outdoors, she had a limb from the front yard pine tree in a pot making tea that she called pine top tea because that's where they grew up, in Pine Tops, North Carolina. So here I am walking in there looking at this tea. She already knew I had a cold for some how she knew, I don't know, before I got there. And Wesley, I told myself, I just paid $600 or $700 to learn that pine needles have vitamin C. And here she is, she grew up with it. And I went, wait a minute, what else does she know? So I started questioning her. All this stuff I had been learning, making fire with sticks, tracking animals, naming the trees, bird calls, she knew all of that stuff, but they had to. So then I realized when grandma says, oh, a little birdie told me, how'd you know, grandma? A little birdie told me. I realized they were serious about that. They were speaking literally, right? So mom and dad, they knew a whole lot of stuff. All our mom and dads did. They had to, or else we wouldn't still be here.
Glenn also asks, and this is a very pertinent question nowadays, I know I'm feeling it, what are some ways that musicians be of service to the spirit of music during the pandemic?
Right. Is to sink your feet right into where you are. A lot of us musicians are, instead of really firmly being where we are and making this better, where I am and making myself better, we are dreaming of playing live again. I can't wait until I'm with my friends. I can't wait until I can tour. We're missing this opportunity. This is the chance when you're climbing the mountain to stop, take some water, eat a granola bar, look back where you've come from and refuel. So what we can really do is all the things we know, solidify them deeper. Really learn to listen to music again, right? Our attention span has really shrunken. We'll listen to a few seconds of a song and then skip to the next one. Listen deeply. Let the music really, like, let it caress you. Talk to music, right? Understand that music is not in a guitar. The music's in you. You just use the guitar to play it. So as far as music goes, develop and rekindle that keen, real relationship with music, where it's two-sided. Not just me telling music what it's about, what to do, where we actually listen, right? The same way you might rekindle a friendship with someone and you listen to that person and then you talk to that person and your bond gets closer. We need to do that with music. As music said in the music lesson, I need to be felt.
Owen Reagan asks, can Victor talk about some of his musical idols that inspired him?
Yeah, there are plenty. Very, very, a whole lot.
Pick three.
Okay, James Brown, for one. Not only for his music, but what he was doing for his people. Mm. James Brown James Brown had a lot of money for an African-American. He owned an airplane, but he would also go into a town. Instead of just doing a concert, he would rent the venue. He would rent the whole venue and hire Black people from the community and give them a job that night. Let them make money, let them work, and then he'd do a concert. He was also the guy that President Johnson called when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Yes.
And James Brown was performing in Boston, which was
fantastic. That's a great story. The Boston
absolutely
story. He calmed the city down, right?
Exactly right. So we know nowadays James Brown is portrayed as a crazy, out of his mind guy, and he probably did end up there. But anyone who lived through what he went through would probably end up there a lot sooner than he did. But he brought a lot of people further. To have a song that said, "Say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud." Back then, that was like a death sentence, but he put it out anyway. So James Brown is, I could say James Brown is one, two, and three. Yeah. But James Brown is one. There were so many. I also love Willie Nelson. I really love Willie Nelson because is he the best singer? Like, would he go far on that TV show, The Voice? Probably not. Is he the best guitarist? Probably not. But if he plays one chord and sings one note, I guarantee you, you will stop whatever you're doing and you'll listen. So for me, Willie Nelson, and he's not the only one. I could say Bob Dylan. You know, I could say Otis Redding, Stevie Wonder. And Stevie Wonder is going to be my third one anyway. But there's a ton. It's hard to keep it down to three. Stevie Wonder is an utter genius. He's more of a genius than people know. Let me just share one thing. Stevie Wonder has a great song that just says, "I just called to say I love you." Now, what I'm going to tell you, I wasn't clever enough to figure out myself. But a friend of mine, we both talk about Stevie Wonder a lot. And my friend came up to me and he said, "You know, every time I'm learning a Stevie Wonder song, the melody's so simple. Like overjoyed, da da da. But then I go to learn the chords and it's like a jazz masterpiece. I didn't realize it was that hard." So he's disguising simple stuff. But my friend says, I listened to I Just Called to Say I Love You. And he said, the chords are simple. It's like three chords over and over, 2-5-1. He says, Stevie's a genius. I know the genius is hidden somewhere. And then he looked at the lyrics. And I've been hearing these lyrics. You've been hearing them. Everyone out there has been hearing them. None of us realize this. No New Year's Day, January. To celebrate, no chocolate, candied hearts to give away, Valentine's Day, February. He goes through every month of the year. He gets up to June, and he goes to the chorus. Then he comes back, no warm July, and he goes through the next 6 months. It's like, poof, genius. He's just amazing, you know, and he learned a lot of what he learned from Donny Hathaway. So Donny Hathaway is in there also.
Oh, Donny. And, you know, and of course, the huge tragedy about Donny Hathaway is there's a man who basically had the most amazing voice in the world and was such a, you know, a, whatever he was, a depressive or whatever he was, that he believed that it was his voice that was letting him down. And the voice that you and I hear, that we feel to be the most beautiful voice we've ever heard, Extensions of a Man, is a mind-blowing album of orchestration and joy, and yet it's his voice that he felt let down by. It's so horrific.
And jumped so out, terrible. Committed suicide by jumping out of a like 13th floor of a building or something.
Yeah, just terrible.
Wow. Yeah. So good questions by these people.
Oh yeah, I know. Really good. Okay, we got time for a couple, maybe one more, maybe two more.
Okay, I'll try to be fast.
Depends how long your answer is. okay, this is a good question, and I loved your answer about the pandemic, by the way. But it sounds like family is very important to you. How do you find time to balance performing, traveling, and now writing with maintaining a family?
Okay, so if you have a family, that means you're not the only one that can balance it, right? It has to be help. It has to be in balance with other people. I'm lucky enough to have an incredible wife who helps me balance. I also have an incredible manager. So my wife, if I'm on tour or even if I'm home, I know my wife has taken care of everything at home. I don't have to worry about the kids. Because the big part of my life is touring and playing and business, I've got a manager who helps take care of my business life. She makes sure I don't have to worry. Even tonight, Victor, you have your link. She texts me, here's your link for tonight. She's taking care of that. My wife is taking care of home. They're helping me keep balance. But I still have to do my part, right? I have to be the guy that's honest, that my wife trusts when I'm away. I can't be the typical version of what we think a musician does. I can't be out there drinking, womenizing, all that kind of stuff. So I have to do my part. But the short answer is I can't keep balance without help. And it's the help that really keeps the balance for me.
And if as you say very well, the question, good question, but it kind of presupposes that it's actually all on you. And of course it isn't all on you, because every marriage and every family is a balance of all the parts involved in it, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. And I would say this too, Wesley, every life is like that, because we all think whenever we have something good in our life, we want to share it. I want to post it on Facebook. I want to tell everyone. But when we have a huge problem, we want to go in and deal with it by ourselves. And that's when we can become overcome with it, like Donny Hathaway and many, many others.
Yes, yes.
But you never have to go through anything in life by yourself. Even when you don't think you have friends, there are people just willing to help you out. And we need to seek out those people to help us regain balance. But we also have to remember is that life will become boring if we just maintain balance, right? We have to dare to become uncomfortable a little bit to grow. That's a part of it.
As my friend, a great singer called Reckless Eric from England, who had the big hit "World Whole Wide World" that they have in "I Go the Whole Wide World," as he said to me, I said, "Oh, I've made a new album." He said, "Oh, were you comfortable making it?" I said, "No, actually, I wasn't. It was a bit of a trial." And he went, "Good."
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Last question.
Yes,
last
I love question. It. All right.
Yeah, and it's been so enjoyable talking with you this evening. Thanks for putting up with all these questions and my questions and everything. But here's the last one before we say goodbye, and it's a lovely one from Scott Matthews. Who would you like to work with that you have never worked with?
There are few, but I don't spend much time on it because I've been so fortunate. And if life brings me in their direction, I'm happy. So I don't sit around wishing. I don't. I spend more time in gratitude of the people I've and the things I've been allowed to do. But there are still many of my musical heroes that are still alive. That would be great.
We're not going to let you get off that easy. You've still got to come up with a name.
Sure. There are many. I've never worked with Stevie Wonder. I'm mentioning him. I've worked with his musicians. I'm a great good friends with his bass player over the last 30, 40 years. George Benson, a great guitarist. I've never worked with him. Carlos Santana, I've never worked with. You know, I can mention lots of people, there are a bunch in all genres of music. But more so, I've been lucky to get to work with a lot of people that were not even on my radar, like a banjo player, Bela Fleck. That was not on my radar. You know, a prog metal band, Nitro, calls me to do the prog metal. Chick Corea calls me one day to play upright bass, something I don't do on his tour. I've been very, very fortunate. So, you know, my wishes are small right now. They're more gratitudes.
Then one more question. I toured with and made music with another great bass player, a guy called Rob Wasserman.
Oh, my goodness.
Bass.
Yes.
Yeah. He and I did a tour together, literally acoustic guitar and bass. And he was a great friend of mine in San Francisco and in Mill Valley when I lived there. He was another person like you. So this is another last question. He was another person like you who crossed many genres. Like, he could play with Lou Reed. He made acoustic things for Spike Lee movies. He played with jazz people. He was a great bass player, as you yourself are. Is that a particular, this is why it's a good closing question, is that a particular magic of the bass, do you think, that makes it so cross-genre?
Yes, bass is still an instrument that can surprise people. Right. If you get on the piano and play the bass part, the chords and the melody at the same time with good rhythm, people are like, yeah, that's nice. If you do it on guitar, yeah, that's nice. If you do that on bass, people stop in their tracks.
Yeah.
We're still at the place where we're used to the bass being unnoticed. Right. You miss us when we're not there, but you don't notice us when we're doing our job.
Yeah.
So a real bassist, I call it an instrument of service. It was designed to make other people sound better. Rob Wasserman knew how to do that. There's a lot of great bass players that you don't even know their name, but you know the people they played for, you know, because that's our job. That's their job. If I'm playing with you, Wesley, my job is to make people look at you. That's my job. That's what the bass is for. But you get people like Rob Wasserman, and he was one of my heroes, still is one of my heroes.
Great. Amazing. Fantastic.
Oh, totally. Totally. Because he took that instrument and blew the box wide open.
Yeah.
He, with that bow, he played melodies. He had great rhythm. He would use pedals. He would use effects. And all of a sudden, what was an instrument that was known to be in the background, he blew it into the forefront. And, you know, maybe the whole big world, mainstream world, doesn't know his name, but us musicians do. And any bass player that's,
sounds like I have a couple of MP3s you're going to want to hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, well, I want to hear some of that tour, because I remember if it was just you and him, I remember when that tour was happening.
Yeah, it was like 94, 95, or 96, I'd say.
Absolutely. That sounds exactly right. I'm not good with years, but I remember because the thing was, bass and guitar like that, not Rob Wasserman style bass. This had not been done.
I don't want to talk about me. I want to talk about you. You know, thank you so much for this book, The Spirit of Music. Thank you so much for talking to us tonight. And also I want to thank people for their really excellent questions that were coming along the side. I was just trying to keep up with them all. Thank you also to the Philadelphia Free Library for hosting us this evening. This has been a terrific evening. And most of all, thank you tonight to Victor Wooten.
I appreciate it. Thank you everybody for being a part of it. Wesley, it's a joy to talk to you. Yeah. Hope we get to spend some time, you know, in person when things open back up. And I'll just say for everyone out there, you know, I think music brought us together, and that's what music is good about doing, is bringing people together. And when music brings people together, we kind of forget about who voted for who praised the who, how much money you make, the color of someone's skin. Music erases all of that. And we're just there. Music is powerful, which is why I think the phasers in this book are trying to get rid of it, because it's bringing people together. But if you think about what music is to you, if you answer, fill in the blank, music is whatever you fill in the blank, you'll realize that you won't say music is an instrument, music is scales, music is notes, music is theory. You're going to come up with a word that's so beautiful. And if that's what it is to you, that's what music is looking for from us, is to remember what it really is. Yes, we need the tools, we need the instruments, we might even need some theory to express music, but don't mistake the tools for the destination. Music is broader than a bass. Music is broader than some notes, 12 notes. It's broader than theory. We need to get back to the essence of what music is. Music needs us, because music will be drastically different without it. And I think it's kind of fitting that I literally wrote this book before this pandemic. But with this quarantine and the pandemic, we're starting to realize the importance, not only of music, but of live music and making music with people. And I'm loving that. And I'm thanking the pandemic. If it took a pandemic to bring that back, then I thank it. And I know that we're going to get back. We're going to be jamming together, and we're going to love it. A handshake is not going to be enough the next time we see each other. And I love that. So
yeah, that's right.
Yes.
We now realize what we took for granted.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. And to you too.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.